The Babylon Project podcast was our last best hope for reruns. It failed. But in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater. Our last best hope for fandom. The year is 2017. The place, the Babylon Project podcast.
This is Maggie Egan, your ISN news anchor, and you're listening to the Babylon Project podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hi there, Babylon 5 fans. Welcome to, this really isn't going to be an exciting episode of the Babylon Project podcast. We're in the middle of season 3. We are in the middle of the series, and we are joined, as always, by my good friend Jim Arrowood. Hey, Jim. But howdy. We are also joined by our, good friend, military consultant, wonderful favorite contributor, J.P. Harvey. How are you doing, sir?
Doing fine tonight. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, always. You're always welcome.
Yeah, we need to do this more often.
Basically, if there's an episode you want to be on, you tell us and you're there.
Outstanding.
Yeah, now we just have to get Troy online with us.
Why haven't we done that?
You know,
he prefers to stay in the background.
Yep, which is a shame because if you've ever heard him talk, he's got a great set of pipes. Well, sir, actually, I have to be a little more specific tonight, don't I? So, well, Jim, what episode are we going to be discussing?
Well, tonight we are going to be looking at Point of No Return, the 9th episode of the 3rd season.
Mm-hmm. I believe this is the middle part of what I had previously called a roller coaster.
Yeah, it's kind of like a trilogy. Mm-hmm. The last episode, this one, and the next one. This would be the, I guess you'd call it the swing episode.
Yeah.
There's a...
For the trilogy, for the season, or for the series?
For the season, I would say.
I'd say for some of our characters, it will probably be in their whole character arc, in fact.
Well, it's... There's quite a bit of exciting stuff going on in this episode, mm-hmm. that is for sure.
Certainly. I think probably our best approach then is not waste any time and get straight into a summary.
Archive. Access. Initiated.
Chaos has broken out on Earth when, after declaring martial law, President Clark further dissolves the Senate and orders his elite guard to open fire on the senators. Some escape and go into hiding, others are killed, and some have barricaded themselves in their offices. Meanwhile, General Haig attempts to mount a resistance against Clark while on the run on the Earth Alliance ship Alexander. The political office on Earth has also declared that the Night Watch is to replace Earth Force security everywhere, including on Babylon 5. When Garibaldi confronts the leader of Night Watch on the station, and Zack, he is urged to join Night Watch to keep his position. When he refuses to become part of the Night Watch, Garibaldi is relieved as chief of security and replaced by Zack. Sheridan protests this action to General Smits on Earth and is told that he is to respect the chain of command no matter what happens. It isn't long before Sheridan realizes that Smits has given him a coded message telling him that since the order for Night Watch to assume the security duties has not been given by his military superiors, he is under no obligation to obey those orders. Sheridan, Ivanova, Garibaldi, and Jakar persuade Zack, who is no longer wanting to be a member of Night Watch, to convince the Night Watch leader on the station that a group of Narns are to be installed as station security to replace them. The leader of Night Watch sees an opportunity to remove Sheridan from command for committing treason. He arms the rest of his Night Watch people and heads off for a confrontation with Sheridan and the Narn. Upon arrival at a docking bay, Zack barely escapes as the members of Night Watch are trapped in the docking bay. Sheridan orders them to disarm, and the Narn do actually take over as station security. The late Emperor Turhan's third wife, Lady Morella, arrives on the station under the guise of making a goodwill visit to the station, but she has actually been invited by Londo to tell him his future, as she is a seer. She tells Londo that he has three chances to avoid the fire that awaits him, and that he will become emperor. She also tells Veer that he will become emperor. One, either Londo or Veer, will succeed the other after death, but she does not reveal which one dies first. Garibaldi releases Jakar 3 weeks early from his incarceration because of the trouble that has arisen on the station. When Jakar arrives at his quarters, he finds that Talon has been waiting for him. Jakar tells Talon that some will have to be sacrificed for the good of everyone. Jakar also offers the services of the Narn on the station to replace the Night Watch as the security force on the station in exchange for being brought into the inner circle of the alliance that is being formed. Well, there it is.
That's a lot of there, too.
Oh, yeah. It's a thick episode. Mm-hmm.
Character files opened.
Okay, Jim and JP, we have one heck of a guest cast. Small, kind of targeted, but major piece of guest casting. In fact, I'll toss in a comment real quick. The guest cast made this one of the more controversial episodes and actually pulled a lot of angst from some groups. But we'll get to that as we go along. So who do we have, sir?
Well, we start out our list with our special guest star, Majel Barrett, as Lady Morella.
Yay!
Yeah, Trekkies need no more introduction for her. This is, of course, her only appearance on Babylon 5, and other than several incarnations of Star Trek, she also appeared on another Roddenberry show called Earth, The Final Conflict.
Yes, she did.
Yep.
This actually was the one that I was referring to as far as the controversy. I don't know who here was really watching the show on its original airing and following on the internet. At that time, it was primarily through Usenet. But there was a lot of brush fires when it was announced that she was going to be on Babylon 5, even more so than Walter Koenig. At the time of the original airing, there was a lot of angst between Star Trek diehards, particularly DS9, and Babylon 5, the Babylon 5 fandom. And it was, by some, almost treated like a betrayal. And the funny part is, Straczynski wrote Lady Morella specifically for her. And both of them were very much on the record as like, you know, put the bickering aside. Star Trek is Star Trek. Babylon 5 is Babylon 5. They're both good science fiction. So deal with it.
Yeah. So I did watch the show, both shows, when they originally were aired.
Ditto.
When I could catch it. Babylon 5 was kind of moved all over the place, and it was kind of hit or miss to catch. It didn't cause me any trouble at all. I thought it was pretty cool.
I thought it was great.
I enjoyed it and caught later in this episode, in fact, what I believe was another very loving tip of the hat to Trek in a line that was delivered. So when we get there, I'll bring it up if you guys don't beat me to it.
I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm going to give it to you.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Who else do we have?
Marshall Teague as Talon, and we have talked about him before.
Correct.
And then we have Vaughn Armstrong, and he appears as security guard number one. We talked about him in the last show. Again, he is no stranger to fans of Star Trek. So I'll refer you to our last episode if you want to hear more of an extensive list of his credits.
Very, very extensive list of credits, actually.
Yes. Louis Arquette appeared as General Smits. Mm-hmm. This is only appearance on Babylon 5. He has credits back to 1965, including The Man from Atlantis, The China Syndrome, The Incredible Hulk, The Real Ghostbusters, and Quantum Leap.
Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of voiceover work, too.
Oh, yes. Great deal of it. Moving right along, we have co-starring Ed Trotta as General O'Reilly. This is also his only appearance on Babylon 5. He was on Voyager, Star Trek Voyager. So we've got some Star Trek alumni invading the show tonight. And
importantly,
mostly, though, since 2010, his work has been video game voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not least, everybody, are you ready for this? Maggie's back.
Yay!
As Jane, the ISN newswoman.
Yeah, our favorite.
Yep, so there it is.
Okay, with a cast like that, you're going to expect a lot. And I think it's going to deliver.
Initiating plot analysis.
It starts off on a rather humorous note. Londo and Veer. Veer's visiting Bab 5 and they are back at it. You know, I do a lot of writing in my day job. And I have a saying that I tell people, a good editor is worth their weight in gold.
Oh, boy.
Londo's editing, well, dubious is very important. Let's hear it.
No! No, this report is totally inappropriate. You have to do it again.
Londo, why? I've spent weeks working on this report. I didn't even sleep on the flight back from Minbar so I could go over it again. I've checked every single detail myself. It's absolutely accurate.
Yes, Veer, I'm sure it is, and that is the problem. Here, you say, the Minbari have carefully preserved their cities over the course of centuries.
That's right, absolutely.
No, what you should say instead is, their cities are very old, indicating a decaying culture.
What?
And here, the Minbari put great emphasis on art, literature, and music. Yes, or could say instead, they are decadent people, interested only in the pursuit of dubious pleasures. The dubious part is very important. Doesn't mean anything, but it scares people every time. All right?
Londo, every time I make a report, you do this to me.
Yes, Veer, I'm trying to help you. A report that will be circulated at the royal court needs to be phrased carefully to make sure they appear less civilized than we are. Keeps the emperor happy.
I thought the purpose of filing these reports was to provide accurate intelligence.
Veer, intelligence has nothing to do with politics. Here, they are tolerant of differences among other cultures. No, make that they have no well-defined sense of morality. They'll love that back home.
Londo, that's it. I've been up for a day and a half working on this report. You want to make notes? Fine, you make notes. But you have me locked up in here ever since I got back. Now I'm going to go and I'm going to get some sleep. And then I'll come back and we'll try to work this out.
Oh, I love it.
I've worked for guys like that the adage is it's easier to edit than to create. I remember learning as a junior officer to, the boss would say, I need you to write something, create a briefing or write a memo. and you put your heart and soul into it, and they bleed all over it, and it looks nothing like you started with.
Oh, God.
I learned quickly that after feeling like Veer on the inside, two important things. One is it's easier to edit than create. And the other is, if it's not your name that goes at the bottom, it's not your report.
Okay. Yep.
That got me through a lot of trauma as a young guy. And I would give that advice to people that would draft things for me as a more senior officer, is don't be insulted by what I do to it. You're helping me immensely by creating the document that I get to edit.
Right.
So, and I say all that not to give Londo any benefit of the doubt. The guy is, what was the word you used, Raul?
Dubious.
Dubious. Right. But yeah. I felt Veer's pain.
Oh, gosh. Well, right after this clip ends, a message comes in that an audience with Lady Mirella has been approved. This is the Emperor's third wife. And Londo makes a comment that should tell you where this entire episode is going to go. He says, things must go smoothly. Right. On Babylon 5. Yeah.
Never happens.
Cut to commercial. Come back. And Smooth gets a real good start. Martial law is declared this on Earth. The Senate has been dissolved. General Haig is somewhere on the run on Io. And troops have opened fire on the Senate building.
Yeah. This is all really scary stuff.
Very, very scary stuff. Sheridan gives a briefing to the command staff, and okay, they're expecting a similar order for themselves as well soon.
Oh, by the way, did you remember what Sheridan said? He said everything is going to hell.
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed that every time something goes bad on Babylon 5, somebody says everything is going to hell?
Or has gone to hell.
Or, yeah. It's, I don't know.
It happens later in this episode, doesn't it? Or maybe it's the next one, too. There are two of these close together.
Yeah.
Two people uttering that phrase.
Like Jim says, it gets mentioned a lot.
It's one of Garibaldi's favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, so let me chime in on the martial law thing.
Please.
And all of the swirl around that. So I had noticed when that happened in the show that the Senate is dissolved by executive order. And my reaction to that when I heard it was that couldn't happen under our U.S.
At least not under our federal constitution.
Right. There's not a provision in there. There are provisions that allow for national states of emergency and the imposition of martial law, which is still governed by law. But there's not in our democracy anything that would allow the president to just dissolve one of the other branches. So right away, that alarmed me as well. But I wonder, just like some of the other shows that I've been on with you guys, whether or not we're looking at a system that mirrors ours, or if this is something else being set up in the show. And that answer is going to come. Jim, when you say this is scary stuff, that was my reaction. And there's a lot of dynamics here that'll play out. You know, one is the military here in the real world, our military is obligated, takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution, works for the president, is a part of the executive branch with oversight and authorities given legally by Congress. But the oath is to the Constitution, and this does come up later, so I'm not going to comment too deeply on it. But we serve, because of that, the president, the person in the office, but that's regardless of what we think about the person.
And also, if I recall, protect and defend the Constitution also by obeying the lawful orders of officers appointed above us.
Yes, and that was my last point here. And some of this will come up or unfold as the episode continues. But there are provisions inside of the authority given to commissioned officers and their subordinates. There are legal ways to disobey orders, and the biggest example of that is when a superior officer or even somebody up to and including the president issues an unlawful order. So that's the dilemma that they're setting up here, is what he's doing unlawful, or is it lawful and unsavory? And we'll let that kind of unfold, but I wanted to make that point at this point that at least in the real world, and I suspect with this world that we're looking at in Babylon 5, a president just turning and saying, I dissolve the Senate, that's not an appropriate behavior for a president.
No.
So
at least under the American system.
Right. So now we're going to see how it unfolds. But that was where my mind was at this point in the episode was, well, that was a big red flag if this mirrors the real world. For our system, our constitutional system.
Though under some of the European democracies and some of the other, even more third world, quote unquote, democracies, we do see things like this.
We sure do.
Happening.
Yeah. It's pretty brilliant the way our constitution is set up to not allow for things like that to happen.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people just call it checks and balances. And when they talk about checks and balances, they think about, okay, you've got the legislator, the executive, and the judiciary, but they really don't understand the extent and depth of the interactions that the Constitution itself places in there. And there's even checks within checks in what is, I mean, let's face it, it's not a huge document, but its brilliance of it is incredible.
Well, one of the principles that'll come up is this, not only this episode, but the next whole section of the story unfolds, is a concept that we teach to our officer candidates, to our trainees, cadets, is moral authority. When we teach about the authority that a commissioned officer holds, there are whole segments of the education that revolve around moral authority. And I'll lay that out there, and we'll come back to it as we watch how Sheridan and his command staff and Haig and some of these other characters behave.
Okay, that'll be great. I do want to point one thing out as far as the structure. It wasn't in my notes specifically, but when you look at the way martial law was declared, the dissolution of the legislature and some of the actions, there are parallels. You will see some, you have some parallels to Great Britain with respect to the American colonies near the founding, too.
Yes.
If you remember, King George did dissolve legislatures, some of the ways the martial law was declared, and the way some of the troops. So there's some additional parallels that we'll see in that. And again, speaking of, I love it as far as the moral obligations. We'll see that actually come to more fruition in our next episode when Sheridan has to face some of the questions that some of our founding fathers, some of our founding military generals had to face as well.
So you're saying the episode title was well selected, Point of No Return.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah.
Well,
anyway,
Sheridan, yes.
Moving along a little bit, we have a General Haig is on the run.
Mm-hmm.
And they are looking for him in 9 different systems.
Right. This comes up while they're briefing the command staff, or while Sheridan at least is briefing the command staff, because they're expecting a similar martial law order soon. And that's kind of what I was getting a hint towards here.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some of his own dilemmas. Yeah, it's turning into an all-out civil war.
Yeah, turning into a shooting war.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, you know, that description of senators locking themselves in their offices and running for cover and all that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So things have gotten really bad. Anybody who would hear something like that and say, oh, well, makes me a little apprehensive.
By the way, the the lieutenant asks a question at the end of Sheridan's statements, or toward the end of them. Do you remember what that was?
It was, what did we do wrong?
What did we do wrong? And there's not an answer given. But if you guys can help me remember that he asked that question, the answers are going to come not as a, hey, remember you asked this question, here's your answer, but we're going to get the answers to that open question throughout the next few episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
Right. Zach is not having good luck with the Night Watch.
No, he's told there is a meeting and he is to be there.
And to bring spare ammo.
Yep.
Points of no return.
Well, you know, he's sold his soul for 50 credits.
You know, Jim, you made a comment at the end of last episode about that armband being tight.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I'm agreeing with you on the idea, but I don't think that armband is tight around his arm at this point. I think it's tight around his neck now.
Yep.
And I am going to take a lesson from Jakar. If for some crazy, insane reason I ever get tossed in jail and I want to get out, I'll just start singing.
Well, they'll do one of two things, Raul. They'll either let you out in a real big hurry, or they're going to frag the place.
You're saying that even Jakar sings better than I do.
Yeah, right. I would.
Moving on. Okay. But there is a point to the whole Jakar scene, not just to get him out of jail. Obviously, they can't keep him in a cell for the rest of the season. But he's been thinking. He's got ideas, and he might have something for Mike when the time is right.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling the time is going to be right very soon now as well.
Well, with the upheaval and security, there's no point in keeping him.
Right.
Held. There's nobody there to take care of him because security has been turned over to Night Watch.
And, well, not yet.
Or will be turned over to Night Watch. Yeah. Okay.
But they've got more important problems than a Narn who's had a religious experience writing a book.
Uh-huh.
So, talked about the Narn. Let's go back to Londo waiting for Lady Morella. Now, I don't think we mentioned this yet, but she not only was Turan's third wife, she is also a seer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was originally put under the context of a goodwill visit, but the real point, Londo's motive is, as he tells Vera, he wants her to see for him. And it's not so much knowing what's going to happen. He wants exactly the opposite. He wants to know if what he's seen won't happen. You know, I think we talk about choices and choices catching up with you. I think Orlando's starting to realize some of that now as well.
Yeah. Well, Lady Morella, she addresses that too. She says there's always choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of choices, Sheridan is having his worst day ever on Babylon 5. And he's getting a briefing from General Smits. This is where the political office has assigned all security on the station to Night Watch personnel exclusively. Sheridan's rather floored, but the general suggests that he look at it as an opportunity.
Yeah, there was a lot of veiled stuff coming from that general, and you could tell by the lines that he emphasized,
mm-hmm.
you know, respect the chain of command. Look at it as an opportunity.
Right.
So he was giving Sheridan the orders, but at the same time he was in code telling him to do what he's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
This was my first hint that Straczynski was looking or was using a system that we would identify with as Americans. When he delivers those lines that you're talking about and then says, right. The one in particular that caught me was, I told you where this comes from. That's when I had okay, this is still as bad as it looked to start, but now there's opportunity. the word that he used for Sheridan.
Yeah, it opens the door to strictly interpreting how things work.
And it doesn't register with Sheridan. Not yet.
Not yet.
Not right away, no.
I think he's still a little too floored by what's happening for it to really connect yet.
You know how I would equate the feeling that I think Sheridan might have? I don't know. He's military. But I remember the day that we started firing, or the evening that we started firing missiles into Baghdad. And I was in a daze for a couple of hours. I mean, wow, we are going to war big time here. And it was a very uncomfortable feeling.
Sobering.
I was devastated. I really was.
Yeah.
So, you know, perhaps Sheridan is maybe having some of those feelings himself, especially as quickly as this has all happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the lieutenant asked the question, what did we do wrong? Sheridan appears not to ask the question verbally, to be thinking, what can I do next? Uh-huh. So the young officer is looking backwards, thinking somewhere somebody's made a mistake. Sheridan's looking ahead, thinking, how do I make this work, or how do I fix this, or, you know, all of the things. And he's going to verbalize a lot of it as the episode unfolds, the things he's wrestling with.
Ah.
What goes through an officer's mind when orders like that come through?
Can only speculate. I've never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I've read about it. I've seen it in other countries, but in the 28 years I served, you know, this situation never unfolded. And there's a huge area between this and everything is roses where lawful orders are issued that a subordinate adamantly disagrees with. That's another problem. It's not a problem, but it's something that kind of like the writing of the memos, right? Londo and Veer, that you learn how to manage and accept and to put into a perspective as a junior person when you watch seniors making decisions, that if you were to put yourself in their position with less experience, you think, I wouldn't do what they're doing. I think that's folly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you handle that? You know, that's not a legal and illegal thing. That is just a genuine difference of opinion about the best way forward. But that's not this show. That's not this problem.
Right. Well, one would hope that the junior officer would trust the senior officer's experience and training and say, okay, well, I don't necessarily agree with this, but there it is.
Right.
You know,
I don't know what's happening, but I'm going to watch my boss or my commander, and I'll trust that person. The interesting thing, throwing that out there, Jim, is that we see a point in the chain of command or in related chains of command where presumably that's going on until you hit General Haig, where he looks at his boss and he says, no, that piece of the story hasn't totally unfolded, but we know that they're looking for him, which tells you he has essentially openly defied the president's orders.
Right.
Yeah. That's got to be a real sick feeling too.
But that's at that level where he turns, all right, perhaps directly to the president, if that's who he works for, if that's his direct commander, and says, I'm not going to follow your orders. And that,
yeah.
So it's, there's so much going on behind the story here that I got to be careful not to take us off off of it. But
no, it's kind of neat.
It's the kind of perspective we're wanting that. I mean, I'm certainly not able to give that kind of a perspective. I don't know how much Jim would be able to or not.
I was a private first class. I was in the band. I never fired a shot in anger, thank goodness. But the only thing I remember, and I may have mentioned this before, is there were some officers on the border between North and South Korea, and somebody from North Korea shot across the border and hit either one of the or two of those officers, I can't remember, And I was at Fort Jackson at the time, and you would not believe the escalation of activity that went on. And, you know, our drill sergeants, they were all just lit up, completely lit up, like, oh boy, we're going to war now. And the tension, you could feel it in the air, that it really escalated. And that's probably my only experience even coming close to anything like that.
Yeah. But as JP said, back, as far as the story is going to make a whole lot of quick jumps. First of all, and this goes straight into the conversation, some of the conversation we've been having. Night Watch, Vaughn makes a statement. I guess security guard number one is his name. I still like the way Straczynski kept him intentionally nameless. But
yeah.
Babylon 5 belongs to the Night Watch.
Well, we know the guy has a god complex because he proved that last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And now everything's been turned over to him. So he is the number one security guy as far as he's concerned.
Right.
Even over Garibaldi.
And as I said last week, that's a lot of security with that armband.
An awful lot.
Talon. He's back. He's been waiting for Jakar. I like the way he waits, stays there a few days, goes, sleeps on, what was it, the 4th, comes back.
Yeah.
And Jakar definitely seems to have something planned.
Yeah, we have a moment of transition here.
Mm-hmm. Zach has been recruited in helping to winnow out the people who are, and this is a scary phrase to use, Zach's helping to winnow out people who are, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, loyal to the Constitution from those who are loyal to the Night Watch and President Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike, up with Sheridan when all this is happening, Sheridan briefs him on the Night Watch situation, and he's just in a bit of a tizzy.
Tizzy? Are you kidding me? He is livid.
Yeah, he's going to be storming down. He's planning to storm down cannons blazing. And
but you know, and Sheridan more or less tells him, you need to be patient here. You gotta back off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing parts of a plan come together, but we don't know what the plan is. So Jakar has that conversation with Talon, and toward the end of it, Jakar says, I may need your help.
Yeah.
Jakar, for once, who is as calm as can be. I may need your help. Then we have Mike, excited as he is. Sheridan, who's laboring with this whole problem.
Yeah, he's and got then, the weight you know, of the
Mike
world.
Mike says, "Well, I'm not wearing the armband," and he's agitated. And Sheridan even says at one point, "You won't have to."
Mm-hmm.
And Mike doesn't hear him.
No.
So Sheridan clearly he hasn't communicated it to any of us, to you know, to the audience.
But he's working.
But he's got a plan now as well, and he doesn't say what it is to Mike. He just says, "You won't have to," and Mike doesn't hear him and keeps ranting.
And Mike, you know, usually Mike has his character. He thinks things through. He doesn't generally just go off on a knee jerk reaction.
Right.
So you know. He's got to be really, really upset.
Okay. At this point, we're switching back to Lady Morella. Mm-hmm. She wants to know why Londo brought her there. And I love not just the actress, but the character. She gets right to the point. She's got a knack for it.
Uh-huh.
And there's actually several really powerful quotes in this episode, and a couple of them are from her. Do you have that first one ready? Because I think JP is going to want to talk about this.
Yeah, I've got it.
I was there when he left us. He was a great man.
Yes. Yes, he was. The greatness is never appreciated in youth, called pride in midlife. Dismissed in old age and reconsidered in death.
Because we cannot
tolerate greatness in our midst, we do all we can to destroy it. This place has become a memorial to his unfinished work.
Well, she twists Londo and gets the truth out of him.
Mm-hmm.
JP, was that greatness line one of the ones you wanted to address?
I didn't have any. I'm going to hold my comments.
Okay. If you've read through some of Straczynski's commentary on this particular line, in a lot of ways, he notes that, amongst other things, that, I mean, this line has got a bunch of levels to it, but he's also making a tribute to Gene.
I would agree.
It's a wonderful tribute.
Yeah, this is a less obvious. This wasn't the line I was referring to. I smiled when I heard it, even though it's not a smiley scene. But yeah, there's another one coming up that was the one I was
okay
mentioning at the beginning. Yep.
Ah.
And it's frankly, it's probably more obvious than this one. But
well, and Lady Morella tells Londo. And Londo says, I don't have any choices. And she tells him there are always choices, which is one of Spock's most famous lines. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, many of Londo's choices have not been good ones.
I'd say most of his choices have not been good. And a lot of his choices are just made out of fear. Because, I mean, to Yoda, sometimes once you start down the path, it will dominate you. And those initial paths that he made were, it seems that there was elements of fear driving him.
Well, you know, falling in with Morden, you know, I think Londo's biggest fear is fading into obscurity.
That's what started him down the steps with Morden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of the tragedy of the character. He wasn't doing it for personal gain or personal greed. It was the Centauri fading to obscurity.
Yeah.
Wow. Wonderful moment for Mike's temper now. Zach gets a little bug that Garibaldi's on his way, and he tries to head him off. He tries to get him to play along, and Mike isn't having any part of it.
No.
Yeah. Who is us?
Yeah. Mike needs to cool his heels here. He really needs to calm down.
Right. Yeah. I mean, technically he's got the right of it. But...
Oh, yeah. You know, Mike is right. There's no doubt about that. But his method is just a little bit, he's like a bull in a china shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and here he stands surrounded by security people.
Right.
And he's really fortunate that some of them or all of them didn't step in and grab him.
Mm-hmm. Well, as it is, our unnamed security guard, who apparently doesn't have any actual, any significant security rank, but political office, relieves him of duty.
Yeah.
Now, that may not be something that can happen here in the U.S., but reflect back to the Soviet Union, the political officer had that authority.
It's a whole different structure, though.
Mm-hmm.
There was a strange statement made here that the first time I saw the show, this episode, I thought that it was going to lead toward the solution, and it ends up going nowhere, but I thought it was a... You know, maybe it was something written in to give the writers additional options down the road. But in that exchange, when Mike is relieved, Zach is put in charge of security, and he's wearing a Night Watch armband. And I wondered when I saw that, oh, this guy just made a mistake. He just put Zach in charge of security. Night Watch is in charge of security.
Zach,
so Garibaldi, you're out as his deputy. You're now the head of security. Well, did the political officer just, in a way, give authority to Zach in a something that he could supplant the political officer now?
Mm.
it ends up that that doesn't seem to play out, really. You know, Zach doesn't turn back to the political officer and say, I am in charge of security. Here's how we're going to do this. But there was a moment of hope, and then my heart was crushed. Mm-hmm. When, when he says, you're now in charge because Garibaldi's out. As his deputy, you're in charge of security. And I thought, but Garibaldi was not Night Watch.
Yeah.
Zach is.
Would have been neat, too, if he had decided that if appointing Zach would further inflame Mike and lead to something else.
Or at least drive a deeper wedge.
And more than Mike being relieved, he becomes arrested instead.
Because he commits true violence at that point, and then mm-hmm. Now it's not a political argument. You broke the law.
Yeah.
I was thinking of a Beckett kind of scene. It just didn't happen, where I was hoping that, you know, with Beckett, when the King of England mm-hmm. says, you're going to be the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
And then Beckett became the Archbishop and it burned the King.
Right.
Yeah. But Beckett said, don't do this. Don't do this.
I thought we might have one of those happening here. Again, back to the very first time I saw this episode, but that wasn't quite how it played out.
I missed it from that perspective, but that was mostly because I was seeing it as one of the things that Clark had done here was, at least with where elements of the military are concerned, had been establishing more of the Soviet model with their political officers and what right. they had the authority to do.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what this was, and not anything more. Because, in fact, he had a different plan for how this was going to get resolved in the storytelling.
Right.
Hmm.
Well, we've get another deep moment from a hothead to a philosophical level. Actually, two philosophical level heads, because Jakar has had his revelation, as he tells T'Lan. And you know what? T'Lan can match Jakar for deep.
Yeah. That surprised me again. I, you know, even rewatching the episode, how T'Lan came back and made him explain himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Let's play it.
You must understand, T'Lan. I have had a revelation.
What kind of revelation?
Most profound and substantial one, T'Lan. Kind of revelation that transforms your mind, your soul, your heart, even your flesh, so that you are a new creature, reborn in the instant of understanding.
That was a stirring reply, Citizen Jakar. Unfortunately, while all answers are replies, not all replies are answers. You did not answer the question that I asked. What do you understand now that you did not understand before?
It's all here in these pages. I have tried to write down what I have seen. It may take the rest of my life to explain what I saw in that one singular instant. Save our people. We must sacrifice our people. We must sacrifice ourselves. Our pride, our vengeance. Be willing to die by the thousands, by the millions, for one another. The more we fight for ourselves, the more we will lose ourselves. We are linked, Talon. Our fate is like an image caught in a mirror. If we deny the other, we deny ourselves, and we will cease to exist.
And who or what is this other?
The universe itself, T'Lan. But the humans, they are the key. And together, you and I and the rest, we will turn that key. Because on the other side is salvation for all of us.
The next set of really powerful lines in a really powerful episode.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is not simply talking about Jakar providing Narns to be support for security at the end here, you know, at the end of this episode.
Uh-huh.
This sets up a lot of what happens with him in the second half, especially of season four. And it sets up a big piece of, big piece of season five. This kind of becomes the part of the basis for season five. The new alliance that comes out of everything.
Yes. In any case, we have got a whole different Jakar here. We've talked about that a little bit before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where it was, you know, he was trying to buy arms and trying to make deals and all this other stuff. He's just kind of backed off and said, hey, you know, we will do what we can, but let's leave it to the people who actually can get the job done.
Yeah.
And what if, as I recall, what did he say could be a consequence of that? What could happen to the people?
Well, they could die by the millions, he says.
Dying by the millions.
Yes. Yeah. And so here's the other tip of the hat to Star Trek that I saw, by the way. Not that this is the Star Trek podcast, but the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. So Jakar has gone from, I'm going to buy guns and move guns. He's very tactically minded.
Mm-hmm.
To realizing that this is a huge thing that's going on and that there's sacrifice involved. And some are going to die for the greater good of others who live. I just, you know, so I had a Spock moment.
Touché.
Bigger picture. Yeah.
Jakar got a vision that was bigger than Babylon 5 or some immediate circle of friends, even if they're on Narn.
Yeah.
You know, he was angry at the Centauri takeover.
Mm-hmm.
But everything he seemed to be doing was focused on the immediate and close in. And he, like you guys said, he's changed. This is a different guy.
Yeah.
Something happened while he was forced to sit and be still and think.
Oh, yeah.
He's gone from, really, I mean, the somewhat reptilian snakishness that he started out as. To, I'd say at this point, he's probably the one that sees the big picture most clearly.
Mm-hmm.
With a possible, and I'm only going to say possible, exception of D'Lynn.
D'Lynn is trained to see the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Jakar was not. So I'll tell you what, that was a huge leap for Jakar.
Yes, yes. You are 100% correct there. Exactly.
So what do we have next? Martial law being established?
We have martial law being established. We just kind of get a little bit of an update here. Martial law is being established on Earth. Mm-hmm. D'Lynn's been gone for a bit, we've noticed, and John's definitely missing her. And still no word on General Haig. He's at the moment in sort of a state of silent running. And
yeah.
Well, actually, that's about to change in the very next scene, because while Malari is giving a tour, the shooting begins.
Yep.
And I need to double check this, but I am almost 100% certain that it is not Haig and the Alexander that starts the shooting. It's Clark opening fire on him, but the end of it is the Alexander is fighting Clark,
mm-hmm.
Which was actually another connection that I made for me, was a connection back to England and our own revolution. One of the things that was a key element for our founders was, as they defined just war, especially in the context of taking up arms against your own government, they would not be the ones who fired the shot.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see more of that.
And we are certainly going to see. Oh, especially at the beginning of next episode, too. Nightwatch gets rather set off because the people are cheering, and they are cheering for Haig.
Mm-hmm.
So did that strike you guys as awkward?
Not really. And the reason I say that is because of the reveal we had before, where the ISN news has shown that Clark was complicit in Santiago's death.
Right. I just, I don't want to say I was surprised by the cheering. Well, I guess I was a little bit surprised. I think, you know, the average man, the average woman, probably not thinking typically about the ins and outs of presidential politics, sees a thing on TV and hears what maybe it's just today's political climate where you go, okay, well, that may or may not be true. And I don't know if there were the people of Babylon 5, as assembled in the Zocalo, were clearly supportive of Haig and the stand he was taking, rather than saying, what is the military doing? Why are they opposing the president this way? Yeah, we heard a report that there's some almost unbelievable story about the president being involved in the assassination of his predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, that's not primary storyline. They needed to get to the point that the main story here unfolds. But it caught me as a pleasant surprise, I guess. It's like, wow, the people on Babylon 5 are depicted as being supportive of the military. That's a good thing for Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Keep in mind, Sheridan has been, I mean, you know, he still walks his rounds. He's been standing up to the Night Watch. The Night Watch has been flexing their muscle. We've been seeing stuff now where what's been happening, you know, how do I put it? What they're hearing and what they're seeing in front of them aren't matching up. And right. It's their confidence in what's coming out of Clark has been pretty much undermined in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Well, and in light of what you say, JP, I hadn't looked at that angle before, but so, yeah, that would be kind of weird, wouldn't it?
It struck me as strange.
Yeah.
It was a pleasant surprise, mm-hmm. like I said. I think the average man would probably think, regardless of what they thought about the situation, I should be quiet. I need to not draw attention to myself. This is a lot of ugliness going on. So it was a neat, and maybe it was required for the purpose of moving the story along, but I thought, I smiled. It was a pleasant surprise when I saw the people cheer for the reporting about General Haig.
Well, and then something happened here that makes me go back to, instead of being philosophical about what was going on, what actually moved the story along. Is the people start cheering for Haig, and at the same time, Sheridan is saying that no incitement to riot will be tolerated, and who starts the riot?
Night Watch
starts the riot.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing, JP, I think don't underestimate the extent that I think, I go back to the episode where they tried to give Sheridan a political officer.
Right.
You really start to get a feeling that Clark doesn't have a whole lot of support, and I'm not talking about necessarily support with the government. I am a firm believer, at least, okay, and I can only speak for here in America. I can't speak for the rest of the world, but what a lot of the Eastern Seaboard and parts of the West Coast refer to as flyover country with a lot of disdain, I've found to be much more politically astute than they think.
Right.
Mm.
So, well, in that riot, and like you said, the real irony there is who starts it, and it's while Sheridan is making the martial law statement.
Yeah.
Lady Morella, and not so much Lady Morella, but Veer, he throws himself in front of her and gets hurt when the bottles start flying. And Sheridan is, to use one of those other phrases, like gone to hell, really honked off.
Yeah, he's not happy.
No. They've got to do something about the Night Watch.
And well, they've turned into a gang of thugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're not keeping the peace. They're not doing what their charter supposedly is looking for troublemakers. Mm-hmm. I'm using that really loosely, but now they are trying to force their vision onto other people.
And pretty much the whole chain of command is getting thrown out the window in the process.
No, there is no chain of command. It's gone.
And
as far as they're concerned.
Sets off the light bulb for Sheridan.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was Franklin that...
In the conversation with Franklin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chain of command. Political office.
You know where this comes from.
Mm-hmm.
The general said, you know where this comes from.
Right.
Yeah.
Opportunity.
Yeah.
It did not come from the commanders in chiefs. It came from the political office. So,
yep.
Light bulb.
And the light bulb comes on.
Yeah. And next we have Boots. And Jakar has an idea.
That's kind of scary in itself.
Mm-hmm.
This is the new Jakar.
Well, yeah. Now we have the new Jakar here.
Right. And Zach has guests.
Yeah.
Yeah, his door opens and step in.
It's one of my favorite scenes in this episode.
And the entire command staff is standing there.
Yep.
I'll tell you how that makes a person feel. When I was in the Army, I got appendicitis, went to the hospital, and then they sent me home on 3 weeks of convalescent leave. And I don't know what was going on, but I went back to the barracks. I gathered up my things. I changed into civilian clothing to go go head home. I don't know why, but there was a 2-star general, a full colonel, and a couple of lieutenant colonels standing outside our barracks. And when I opened the door, in they walked. And I'll tell you what, you want to talk about scared? When you see that much brass around, all together at one time.
You think, what did
things,
I do?
Things are not good. Well, it was pretty easy for me because they asked me what I was doing. What are you doing, boy? And I said, well, I'm headed home for convalescent leave. And General looks at me. He says, ah. He says, well, are you leaving? And I said, yes, sir. And he says, well, get out of here. Which I did. I left dust and skid marks all the way.
You don't have to tell me twice.
No.
See, I was hoping you were going to tell me that they knew that the band was diminished with your absence.
No, this was in basic training, so I wasn't in band yet.
Oh, my.
At any rate,
we get a flash over to Londo and Lady Morella. She's taking care of Veer personally. For protecting him and taking the blow for her. And in that process, she has a direct contact with Londo. And yes, she certainly does see something.
Mm-hmm.
She is shaken by it. And that's all we get at this point.
Yep.
And speaking of shaken, Zach is giving, I like this, Zach is giving a report to his subordinate as though he's his superior.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a report on his meeting with the captain, and they're planning to undermine Clark with a take over the station with an attempted coup, and they're planning to bring in the Narn to support that action.
Yeah, and you know something's up.
Mm-hmm.
Because Zach has just left that meeting with all the brass.
But is he reporting what the brass wanted to do?
Is this continued betrayal, or is it counter betrayal?
Well,
yeah.
Zach has never betrayed anybody during his time in Night Watch.
The closest was confirming the report that was already known.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So he's, he's been walking a real razor here.
Well, he's not going to be able to straddle the fence anymore. This was the moment.
Uh-huh.
Where he's going to have to make a real decision. And as far as what he's telling the guy, well, Jakar really is recruiting the Narn. We see that in the very, very next episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Sheridan arming up. And, okay, I know we're a family show, but if we can say gone to hell, then I can say Sheridan is pissed.
Mm-hmm.
And determined. And
yep. I love the way the four of them come around the corner marching to that. Yeah, just like a big showdown.
Yeah.
And basically that's what we got.
That's
classic
exactly
showdown coming up.
But we've got four of them, and then you see the entire, it's like they stripped security down to bring in the entire Night Watch.
Uh-huh.
But to answer the question, who's counter betraying who? Zach does the right thing.
Yes.
Darn near loses his leg as that door's coming down, but
yep.
He does the right thing.
So he's turned over his Night Watch brothers, if I could say that. Does he have to refund his Night Watch pay then?
You know, from what we've seen of EarthGov, I wouldn't be surprised if they tried.
Well, yeah, they tried to charge Sheridan rent, so.
Yeah, exactly. But security is restored, and the Night Watch is being arrested for mutiny, actually.
Yeah, and Sheridan tells them, you know, if you don't like it, you're welcome to file a complaint.
Yeah. He points out a senator cannot give you a direct order.
Right.
I like that line. That's why I had a problem with Hiroshi.
Oh, Hidoshi? Yeah.
Or Hidoshi. Yeah, Hiroshi's next episode. That's why I had a problem with Hidoshi in season one.
Yeah, and I think we had JP on for that episode. Mm-hmm. And he explained that to us very clearly. You're not going to get, you are not going to get orders from the legislative branch.
Right. If you get something that smells or looks like an order, there's always a way to confirm that is, in fact, your lawful order with your chain of command.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we have the officers appointed. You ask.
And and back to the beginning of this episode and that break between Haig and the president, in some of our ceremonies, typically changes of command, those words are often shared. The authority of command is uninterrupted and goes from the commander-in-chief, the president, to uniformed commanders, all the way down to that lowest level unit where the commander is actually lawfully in command. It's an unbroken chain of command. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It doesn't include senators and political advisors and anybody else. It's commander to commander to commander.
Right. And the command level just below the president, that would be the Joint Chiefs, right?
No. The Joint Chiefs are advisors.
Ah.
With the chairman being the chief military advisor to the president, or the NCA, the National Command Authority. So the president and the secretary of defense, their senior uniformed advisor is the chairman.
Okay.
The command, if we're talking fielded operational forces, go to the four-star commanders that are in charge of what today we call our unified commands. And then there's also lawful command authorities that go down through the services who provide those forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, that go down through the generals to colonels and so on in the military services themselves.
Mm.
But the chiefs of staff are staff.
Okay.
And you know, that's the surface answer. So the chairman is not a commander. The Joint Chiefs are his collection of advisors that culminate with him and his advice to the president as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Okay.
All right. Is mutiny the correct charge for?
Sure. That's plenty accurate.
Yeah. They just did not respect the chain of command.
Right.
Okay.
And there's levels and layers of complexity about what you do with mutinous people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a part of the show. It's laid out there because we get this pretty cool 180 in the situation, at least there at B5.
Right.
With the people associated with unlawful command are now finding themselves guests of the people who actually have lawful authority over the station. Sheridan and the appropriate crew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Though as Sheridan, or as it's pointed out to Sheridan, the solution is temporary. It's just buying time.
Yes. Because the problem is bigger.
Yeah.
This isn't a mutinous problem at Babylon 5. This is a ripple in the pond caused by a president who is unlawfully in the office issuing orders. Mm-hmm. And then at the highest levels back to Haig, you have a general officer at that level, even though we haven't heard him say it, behaving in a manner that lets us say he has decided, exercising moral authority, that the president is not issuing lawful orders. And he, by the way, totally able to face the consequences of an unlawful president with force behind him. Haig could pay the price. And, right. and doesn't oh, yeah. get to come back and go, but wait, what you're doing isn't right. He could be a dead man, as could anybody all the way down to Sheridan and some of his supporting staff. So there's risk and a price to be paid. Raoul, you brought up the colonial separation from England. Technically, legally, in the eyes of the English, we were wrong. Mm-hmm. And we could. And
Washington would have
right.
been hung for treason.
Right. So, you know, there's great risk when you do the right thing, either in that case, challenging lawful power, or in the case of the show here, challenging unlawful power. That's with real risk. And I think that's what Straczynski is showing us as best he can in a TV show.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, just to tie in where the back to Washington. Remember, that was the whole point, and this is why I love your commentary on moral authority. The whole point of the Declaration of Independence was, and it says there at the very beginning, it was to establish the moral case for their actions
right.
to the world.
Right.
Okay. The profoundness continues, and I see, mean that very sincerely, because we get to Londo's reading.
Yep.
This is a longer clip, but it's a necessary one. It establishes, you know, Jakar has had his turning points. Mm-hmm. Sheridan is, you know, we really see the consequence, which is what a lot of the show is about. It's a consequence. We see the consequences of his turning point next episode. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, and he's got to know this, his taking out the Night Watch, taking out Clark's political arm, basically, that really was his turning point there, because once that happened, next episode's inevitable.
Yeah.
Well, Londo's turning point comes in this clip that you're about to play.
Right.
What we are about to say is for your ears only, Ambassador Malone. We will not repeat it to others in the royal court and suggest you do the same. If it comes out, we will deny this conversation ever took place.
Of course.
You have a chance few others will ever have, Mallari. You still have three opportunities to avoid the fire that waits for you at the end of your journey. You have already wasted two others. You must save the eye that does not see. You must not kill the one who is already dead. And at the last, you must surrender yourself to your greatest fear, knowing that it will destroy you. Now, if you have failed all the others, that is your final chance for redemption.
I don't understand.
The future reveals itself only reluctantly, Ambassador. Take the sign for what it is. Look for it when it appears.
I will. Thank you.
One more thing. You will be emperor. That part of your destiny cannot be avoided.
I see.
You will also be emperor. Why are you laughing?
I thought you were joking.
We do not joke in the face of prophecy here.
We cannot both be emperor.
Correct. One of you will become emperor after the other is dead. It is all we see and all we wish to see.
Sorry, that kind of leaves me speechless.
Right.
Just when she just...
That sucked all the air out of the room.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, Save the eye.
That would do it.
That's all she sees, and that's all she wants to see.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, if she actually wanted to see everything Mallari was into, it'd be enough to condemn him. Anyway, what are these two wasted chances they were talking about?
Yeah, that was one of the big questions for a very long time.
Well, a couple of ideas. One of the wasted chances was when Londo lies about Turhan's dying words back in The Coming of Shadows.
I absolutely believe that that is correct, and I think most of the fandom tends to as well.
Yeah, and the second one is ignoring Urza, who told him to reconsider his actions back in the episode Knives.
I can't disagree with that.
Yeah. It's just an idea. Nothing, I don't think it's anything written in stone.
But what about the destruction of Narn? Or standing up to, you know, to take the stand, to exercise the power that he's accumulated to stand against Reefa there?
Yeah. All very valid.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't think many would, that your first one is pretty much be accepted. There's argument over the first, and what you've said there has been discussed. The destruction of Narn has been another one. I know there's been others that don't pop to the top of my head at the moment. But of course, the next big question is, what are these next three chances?
Yeah, the next three opportunities. Just some ideas I had, I'll throw out there. Either the eye that does not see, looking back, could it be the Centauri artifact they call the eye? Or looking forward, could it be Jakar?
I believe it was Jakar. Remember that Centauri artifact, that the eye has already occurred. So that would be an opportunity pass.
So the one who is already dead, that would be Sheridan.
Certainly.
Because we know he's going to dive off the deep end next season.
He dies at Zahadum, but recovers nicely.
For a brief amount of time. And the greatest fear would be that Londo would die in obscurity.
That's the one that I think that's an aspect of it.
Or to not have control when he has the
keeper. It's the submitting to the keeper.
Yeah.
And the obscurity, I think, is a part of that, but it's also sacrificing himself to the darkness, to the shadows, in essence, knowing that it is going to destroy him.
Yeah. Well, in any case, we better move along because we are running very long.
Oh, yowz. I just saw the recording length here. Those are good questions, but they're going to be ones that are, well, 2.5 seasons to answer. Mm-hmm. Plus the trilogy, the Centauri Prime trilogy, that really gives us the answer. Yep. Night Watch is being herded out. The Narn are on patrol, and Talon's smile at Morella is priceless. Speaking of the Narns being in security, crime's down. Garibaldi's real happy about that. And Sheridan thanks Jakar, and Jakar has a price for his help. He wants in.
Yeah.
He knows something's up. He knows something is going on. It's not entirely Sheridan's decision, at least not yet. But Jakar's comment that he has time, but questions whether or not Sheridan does. It's going to be prophetic as well.
Yes.
The Londo and Veer moment.
Almost comical. Yep.
Almost.
Oh, it's totally comical.
It's comical, but it is dripping with tragedy.
It's sad, yeah, too. That was the almost qualifier for me.
Yeah. Not hungry even for spoof.
It's a temporary situation.
Well, you know, Londo's got to be rattled. And I think just the little element toward Veer's got Veer rattled
too. Oh yeah, something that huge. Mm-hmm. But I think well, Londo and Veer will weather that, and they'll get over that.
Veer's already passed it. It struck me that he doesn't know what to make of it, so he's just going to carry on.
Veer's going to be Veer.
Hey, can I make you dinner? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. From a culture where poison seems to be a most accessible political tool.
I think I'll order in.
Yeah.
Yeah, very Victorian.
Sheridan has more bad news coming. Four of Haig's cruisers have been shot down.
Yeah, it's not looking good.
So his attempt to buy Haig some time, well, as he says, he expects Clark to be coming for them soon.
Mm-hmm.
And the response was, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jim, you have a comment at the end.
Yeah. Susan says, never thought it would end like this. Well, is this an end or another beginning?
It was the dawn of the third age of mankind.
Well, it has been the dawn of the third age for the last 3 years, but...
The beginning of the third age implies the ending of the second, and great ages...
Wait a minute. Are you watching... You're watching way too much Kung Fu, man. You can't be watching it.
I thought you were going to accuse me of Tolkien here.
No. No, and when next we get together for our next episode, you'll see where that question comes from, because I see it as a beginning.
I'm going to agree with you.
You guys remember what the historical, big political military event, historical point of no return. I'm being vague to see if that's resonating with you guys. There's a phrase that's used to mean you've crossed the point of no return.
I'm blanking.
Crossing the Rubicon.
Mm.
Oh.
Julius Caesar and his armies, mm-hmm. when they crossed the Rubicon, it was considered to be the commitment to a course of action that there was no returning from. Totally loosely connecting that to the story, only in that they've, you know, there's a point of no return. Maybe there's fun. I haven't thought about it, but, you know, can we start to equate Caesar's initial success with crossing the Rubicon and ultimately becoming emperor? But he also paid a big price.
Yeah.
So, as I said, I'm being loose with that on purpose, but this was I love the name of this episode. Oh. It works at every level.
It's not what Sheridan does in the next episode. It's this episode that is really the turning point, because of what he did in this episode. This was his Rubicon moment. What he did here made the next episode inevitable.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think we need to wrap this one up.
Well, I am going to give our guest, hopefully more commonly showing up guest, an opportunity for any thoughts.
No, I think I've said all I needed to say or should have said, and I'm flattered that you'd have me back on the next one.
You bring so much to the show every time you're on.
Thank you.
It's just always wonderful to have you.
Yeah. You kind of take the guesswork out of the military things for me.
You guys humble me.
Well, it's not just that. He brings a level. Ah. He brings a degree of wisdom and perspective as well that adds a lot.
Mm.
So you, as I believe it was Jim that said it at times, has noted that you're welcome anytime.
Oh, yes. Please.
Well, Jim, any final words that you're in?
Well, I just thought I would ask JP, was there any boom today?
There was boom. Definitely some boom today.
Figurative boom.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there's going to be some boom tomorrow, I think.
Oh, there's going to be some huge boom tomorrow.
Lots and lots of boom. And there's always boom tomorrow.
Always.
Good night, folks.
Good night.
Podcast terminated.
Thank you for listening to the Babylon Project podcast. You can email Raul and Jim at the Babylon Project podcast babylonproject@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Babylon Project Podcast. On the internet, we are at babylonprojectpodcast.wordpress.com. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on iTunes, or you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the webpage.